toolkit. And then plotagainstimmigrants.com is a new research tool that we released.
Thank you so much, Amy. And any kind of final words?
Really appreciate this. Thanks for all the great community and movement building work that KBOO does.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Have a great new year, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Amy Herzfeld-Koppel, for agreeing to be interviewed. As y'all heard, there are many different ways that you can help the fight and how you can make your community a more hospitable, more lovely place to be for everyone. For Hindsight 2020 and KBOO Portland, I'm Tammy Hapteas. Thank you very much.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 4 o'clock. More Hindsight 2020 coming up next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2020 Portland Mochitsuki Festival on Sunday, January 26th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Viking Pavilion in Portland. The Mochitsuki Festival celebrates the New Year by sharing Japanese-American culture with the community. The festival features hands-on activities for all ages, cultural foods, vendors, and a wide variety of demonstrations and performances, including taiko drumming, Japanese dance, storytelling, mochi pounding, martial art demos, and much more. Again, that's the 2020 Portland Mochitsuki Festival on Sunday, January 26th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Viking Pavilion, 930 Southwest Hall Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KBOO. Consider adding KBOO to your will or add KBOO as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change. But recognizing KBOO along with your family and friends in your legacy giving is a powerful commitment to media justice. Let us know if you add KBOO to your plans. We'd like to thank you for your considerate future gift. Contact us at 503-231-8032. Or email development@kboo.fm to notify us of your plans.
You are listening to Hindsight 2020, a day of special programming debriefing the last 3 years of the Trump regime.
What happened in international news, environmental issues, immigration, and LGBTQ rights? What are the most censored news stories of the last 3 years, and how is the fight against white nationalism progressing at this point?
Captain Hindsight!
We spend this day looking back so we can spend the year working toward justice, equity, and democracy with hope and determination. Thanks for listening.
Escalation of conflict actually came at a very bad time for Yemen and the population of Yemen particularly. Already there was the deterioration of livelihoods for some time, and now this is coming at a time when the people are already weak and a lot of people are actually depending on humanitarian assistance. We see that 61% of the population, which is almost more than 16 million people now, depend on humanitarian assistance. This actually is coming, this escalation of conflict is coming on top of several years of deterioration of the livelihood of the population. Yemen is a country that depends on imports for most of its basic food commodities. That now has been disrupted. Roads, transport, ports are now affected. This is directly impacting on the population's access to food. And this is a very worrying situation that it is coming at a time when we are expecting the agricultural situation also, whatever the country is producing, is actually also being affected so much. The agricultural season is about to start, and this agricultural situation, although it only produces about 5%, 5 to 10% of the country's basic food needs, it produces most of the vegetables. And this agricultural season now is in jeopardy, which means more people who could have produced their own food could actually be affected. So it is a situation where the country which is the poorest country in the Arab region, where the income levels are deteriorating for the last several years, oil production has been affected. The whole macroeconomic situation of the country has been affected. The country which depends on a lot on international trade and imports has lost most of its income. This all together means the country is in dire need of international assistance. But international assistance is again in jeopardy because of the escalation of conflict. Convoys cannot move. We have seen recently that even humanitarian assistance couldn't get in. And only just a couple of days ago, we have seen the ICRC just being able to come in to bring in food assistance. So all these things together, Yemen is facing a grim food security prospect.
Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland. As part of our special programming, Hindsight 2020, I will be playing part one of my interview with Mohamed Al-Ajiri, and then part two, which is an update a year later about him, his life, and his family. In early 2019, Mohamed let me interview him about his situation. He is a Portland resident. He's part of our community, but he's also part of the Yemeni community. And in early 2015, a deadly bombing campaign started in Yemen. Mohamed has been working with city officials, NGOs, and the government in trying to get his family members that are in Yemen out of Yemen. Now, a few weeks ago, Mohamed returned to the KBOO studios and talked to me, gave me an update about what's going on in his life. Now, for the first part, I'm going to be playing my 2019 interview with Mohamed, and then about halfway through, switching over to the most recent update. Thank you very much for tuning in. My name is Tammy Hopdeus for KBOO. Enjoy.
My name is Mohamed Al-Ajiri. I am a resident of the Portland area. I moved to Portland 5 years ago from Corvallis. I grew up most of my life in Corvallis, Oregon. My wife and I live here in Hillsboro, and we have three boys that are going to school here as well, young boys. We are both, I work for OHSU, Oregon Health and Science University. I manage two of their primary care clinics out in Hillsboro and Beaverton. And my wife works for Nike. And we are happy to be here in the Portland area, of course, with quite a different environment than being in Corvallis, Oregon.
Yeah. Oh, so you're really doing the Portland thing with Nike and the university.
The quintessential Portland experience.
It's fantastic.
So my family originally moved from Yemen when I was 10 years old in the early 90s. My dad was getting his PhD at Oregon State University, and I was, you know, just immediately immersed into the school system and made friends and helped my family navigate through the different systems because I picked up a language fairly quickly. And so I would often be the translator for my mom at our appointments and helping her with school stuff for my siblings. And, you know, within the year, I felt pretty integrated with the community and friends in school and all that, and started middle school after that and then high school. And when I was in high school, my family, it was time for my family to move back to Yemen. That's where I came from, and my dad finished his PhD. So I happened to be in the middle of my junior year of high school, so I decided to stay in finishing out the year with some really close family friends who offered to take me in. Once I finished high school, I decided to stay and apply for college and universities, and I did that, and I got accepted to Oregon State University and ended up going to getting my bachelor's degree and then eventually my master's degree. In between all that, got married, met my wife. I met my wife actually before that, but we got married in college. Aww. And decided to just keep raise our families here in Oregon. So.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. I can't
believe it. Yeah, the Pacific Northwest is beautiful. Oregon is a beautiful state, and I don't see myself really living in other states in the foreseeable future, but, you know, for now it's home. Second home. Obviously, my extended family is all in Yemen. Mm-hmm. So I definitely feel my roots in Yemen, but at the same time, being in Oregon for most of my life, it's definitely home.
And you mentioned that your father was doing a PhD here. Could you get a little bit more to that? It was, I believe when we spoke, said it was a UN program.
Yeah, we were here on a UN food program scholarship. He was doing his research in the hazelnut. Oregon was at the time pretty prominent in the hazelnut research, which would help the crops in the agricultural scene in Yemen. So we came on that visa, obviously, and that scholarship. So
that's fun. And what year was that?
This was in 1990.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So it was just kind of like a learning, both countries coming together, from each other.
Yeah, there was a lot of work at the time as it relates to agriculture. OSU is known for its agricultural degrees and programs and research, and so OSU actually brought many Yemeni families from Yemen under the same program, UN program. So when we came to Corvallis, Oregon, there were about 20 families, students and families. After the first Gulf War, those scholarships actually stopped. And so we haven't seen that many Yemeni immigrants or students come to the state until recently with the war, and people actually coming here for different reasons. So, unfortunately. But
so I guess fast forwarding to now, your father, is he still doing stuff?
He's retired. He's in Yemen. And unfortunately, because of the recent conflicts and war and over the past 3 to 4 years, many government employees, officials, researchers have really haven't been very productive. Mm-hmm. He retired early just because he was finishing basically his research and didn't want to do anything new. But others are now sort of just stuck in this limbo situation. And we're trying to figure out a way for him to come visit us or come be with us right now. As I mentioned to you, my family since the war has been displaced voluntarily and involuntarily. So I tried to help them leave the situation to come here, but it's difficult and challenging to bring family members here. Even though I'm here, I'm a U.S. citizen. I have my mom is here actually now finally. But so I have siblings that are still overseas, and including our dad who's in Yemen with one of my younger siblings.
What are some of the challenges and difficulty in order bringing your family members to be with you in a safe country. Sure. What are the issues you're seeing?
In general, it's been difficult to bring family members to the U.S. There's a process, obviously. There's a legal process of you apply for them through the legal channels, and the immigration process is lengthy. It's easier for somebody, you know, gets married and bring their spouse here. It's easier to bring your mother or father. Mm-hmm. But with siblings who are over the age of 18, it takes many, many years. So before this conflict even started, I had really applied for all of them to come here. And I applied in 2007. And they're still sort of in the in line or on the list to be processed.
So it's not a matter of a couple of months. It's
no,
years,
it's
and
years and
years
and years and years. Fortunately for my mother, it was quick. It was a year. And so she was able to come here and able to come visit me and my family once or twice a year. My siblings, not so much. But then with the war and the conflict that ensued in 2015, we were able to try a different path, which is the refugee path. So that wasn't our intention. Our intention to get them out initially was because of the heated bombing campaign at the time. Mm-hmm. We didn't know the situation. And so we figured if we have the means to get them out temporarily for a month or two until things calm down, we would do that, and then they can come back. Well, 2-3 months turned into 2-3 years, and now we're in our fourth year. So when I immediately first helped them get out of the country, they ended up in Malaysia, by the way, because Malaysia at the time was taking Yemeni refugees from, you know, displaced from the war. I went there and tried to register them all with the UNHCR office for refugees. So
in Malaysia.
In Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And also the U.S. Embassy there to help my youngest brother actually expedite his process that I applied for many years ago. So I was fortunate to have his process expedited, so he was able to come here because he was under 18. And the other ones who were over 18, we weren't so lucky, so we just have them signed up as temporary refugees in Malaysia. That process is also lengthy. It was lengthy in the past. It is more so now with the current administration, obviously.
Yeah.
Most people know the travel bans. That's another layer of complexity, because even visiting, which they were able to come and visit in the past, are now no longer able to come visit.
Can't come visit they in the States because of the
with
travel
a legal
ban.
Visitor visa is no longer given to Yemeni residents, unfortunately. So all these compounding factors to make them uniting us has been difficult and challenging, to say the least. So.
And how long has it been since you've seen all of your family?
Well, the whole family hasn't really been together since 2007. I've seen my siblings here and there with these different visits. So in Malaysia, I saw the most of them that were in Yemen. And the ones that live in the U.S. I see, obviously, pretty often just because they're here. But my second youngest sibling I haven't seen since 2010. We actually rendezvoused in France. I happened to be there for my graduate work, and he was there visiting. He's a flight attendant, so he just happened to be there. So we met there. That was the last time I saw him. Our dad I haven't seen since 2007. Mm. So.
And do you talk to them? Do you have any kinds of communications?
We are in constant communication on a daily basis, I would say, through various means. Mm-hmm. The WhatsApp is definitely the easiest way to communicate with people. The phone, obviously, the internet, Facebook, social media. So that's happening. It's just we're trying to figure out plans for the future. Do we continue at this date for the unseeable, you know, foreseeable future, or do we planning for rendezvous somewhere? I know I'm working still with our senator's offices to help expedite the process with some of the foundations here that are helping refugees process their work. We're trying the immigration route as well, of course, with lawyers. So we're trying everything we can to figure out the opportunities for them to come here.
Yeah, and this is, you know, one family, and just imagine the millions of people.
Absolutely. I think I was telling you earlier that I feel fortunate that we even have these opportunities to do this. I mean, millions and millions don't have any means of hope for leaving the country or even coming to a safe area to just be away from the conflict. And those who have been displaced in different countries really are on the same boat as my family is, waiting for the process to work itself.
Bureaucracy.
And of course, again, with the new administration, that created even more challenge just because they reduced the number of refugees allowed. And adding the travel ban, which focuses on people from those countries, including Yemen, made it even near impossible to come here.
That was my 2019 interview with Mohammed Al-Jouri about the Yemeni situation and what that means for him. Coming up next is going to be my 2020 interview with Mohammed, Hindsight's 2020, that's right, part of the special programming for KBOO Today. In this interview, Mohammed gives us an update about his life, his family in Yemen, and everything in between. Again, my name is Tammy Hopdeus for KBOO. Thank you for tuning in.
أنا أترجاك بس تسمع كلامي بعد أحكم ويتحكم أنا أترجاك وحبيبي كلام الناس دي جابوا عني كله كذب.
You're back at the KBU Studios. Thank you so much for coming back. You were here last year around this time, and we were talking about the crisis in Yemen, also speaking about all the wonderful things that you do at the university, and then also your connection to Yemen, your family, all the hardships that you had to go through and they had to go through as well. So if you want to just kind of introduce yourself for the people who don't remember or haven't or didn't listen to the other broadcast and kind of how things have progressed since then.
Okay, well, thank you for having me here again. It's always great for me to be able to talk about some of the issues that are important to me personally and family. And I didn't realize it's been a year, but I guess it is a nice time to kind of review what's happened, if at all. So my name is Mohammed Ali Al-Jouri. I grew up here in Oregon, but I've been in the Portland area for the past 6.5 years. I was here last year discussing my connections to Yemen, which is the country where I was born and came from in the 90s. There has been a war there for the past 5 years. My extended family and my immediate family both have been impacted drastically by this, not only by the war in Yemen, but also some of the political changes that have happened in the U.S. in the past 3 years with some of the immigration rules and policies. And so it was, it was compounded by the war because of various things. So initially when I was here, I mentioned that as a result of the war, a lot of families were able to either leave the code or weather the conditions in the storm of the war. And my family more and more has been trying to get out of the country. I was able to get my immediate family, my siblings and their spouses out of the country a few months after the initial bombing happened. Obviously, the war started by rebels taking over the government, Houthi rebels that were sort of proxy or backed by Iran. That led to chaos in the country, ousting of the former president, and obviously a lot of rioting and some internal conflict. A year later, Saudi Arabia, along with other Gulf countries, created a coalition to try to rid the country of these rebels and restore the political system there. 5 years later, that hasn't happened yet, and it's kind of deteriorated to different factions within the country fighting each other. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia is now basically the only country with that coalition. There's now fighting between Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Qatar for various reasons, but also now UAE's Emirates is in the south, and sort of the sentiment is that they're trying to help with the separation of north and south so that they can keep the south to themselves and be involved in the south. Meanwhile, the Houthis are still fully in charge of the north, and the UN recognized government is basically in Saudi Arabia, so they're remotely leading the country, mm-hmm. if you want to call it that. Meanwhile, 80% of Yemenis have or are living in rural areas, and so their conditions got even worse over the past 5 years. Humanitarian aid is up and down, and the spread of disease in the health system is deteriorating. Displaced people the numbers are increasing drastically every year, and people that were already poor to begin with are even more in harsh conditions since the war. At the same time, the country is sort of running out of water. Mm. Globally, it's known that that region is pretty low as far as the water availability in the region, and so that's going to be an issue in the next few years. And the UN is talking about basically there's going to be some movements this next year, and the main bombing campaigns have stopped, so people at least are not having to face that on a daily basis.
Like the Saudi bombing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's stopped drastically. There's been some peace talks. There's been an agreement that was signed in Riyadh with the recognized government and some of the warring factions in the south, not with the Houthis, obviously. So the UN feels that this is a step forward and there's going to be some better news in the coming year. On the ground and people abroad and myself and others, we don't really have hope in that because it feels like no one has any vested interest in Yemen as a country and its success and its getting out of this difficult situation. UAE has their own interests in the south. Saudi Arabia has its own interests, the proxy war with Iran. Iran has its own interests by having a foothold in the country, especially with what's happening in the news in the last 2 days.
That's what I was going to
more intensified.
Ask you, did the assassination or killing of the military leader in Iraq, does it have any kind of repercussion for the region, for Yemen? Or
It's going to be a heightened sense of you know, insecurity and instability, obviously. Of course, in the U.S., the fear is that the retaliation might be against U.S. interests across you know, the world. I'm not sure what the direct impact is on Yemen currently, but if it's a proxy war between Iran and Saudi, I'm sure the U.S. would be involved in trying to use that as a way to protect U.S. interests there, too. Yeah. So not much has happened. The past 5 years, things seem to be calming down as far as the immediate day-to-day conflicts, but the people aren't happy with the current state. Obviously, there's no stable government.
It's very it's in limbo. It doesn't sound like there's much.
The airports are still shuttered, except for the south. On a personal note, our dad passed away in October.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. It's and we our goal was for us to obviously you couldn't come here. A, there aren't any open airports nearby. He was not feeling well. My family couldn't come here, or we couldn't go there because of that. So we decided to meet neutrally in a different country, in Malaysia, where my sister had been since I got them out 5 years ago. And he couldn't make it. He had surgery there, and he had to wanted to stay and sort of recover before he traveled. The healthcare system, there's, as I mentioned earlier, isn't at its greatest right now. It's pretty dismal. So he was recovering there, and it didn't have a good outcome, and he unfortunately passed away. So I ended up going to Malaysia before that anyway, meeting my sister and my siblings there who could make it there. He stayed behind. My sister, who lives in the U.S., actually really wanted to go and see him, and she sort of went against my wishes as far as like I was hoping she wouldn't go in this situation, and she decided to go anyway. It took her like 5 days to get to Yemen through Egypt, waiting for available flights, flying through to south and to Aden, taking a long 20-hour car ride across the desert to the capital, all that with the risk of anything happening. Obviously, she was able to see him for a day, believe it or not, and then he passed away the next day. She made it back safely. But that's the kind of thing people are facing. And it's not just me and my family. Other families are facing the same thing where people haven't seen each other for years, or, you know, loss of jobs and income in the country, no healthcare system. Humanitarian aid in the rural areas is almost none. It's just a limbo, like you said earlier. Yeah. So it's really hasn't changed much. And I'm hopeful that it's maybe people will see that as a time to talk and create some peace talks. The UN really needs to step up and create more of a robust dialogue instead of just trying to work with each faction separately. But I don't see that in the next year, hopefully. I mean, I don't, it's hard to tell, really.
Do you still have family in Yemen left now?
I have my one brother left, plus my entire extended family, uncles, cousins, aunts are all still there. More and more, you know, as time goes on, we have a family that we find out they've left. They're in Egypt, or they're in Sudan, or in Turkey, where Jordan, wherever they're able to land and have available help to kind of settle down until either the situation is over or sort of start a new life somewhere else.
Wow. And how do they express, like, moving somewhere new and having to, like, what's their lives like? Do they have to rely heavily on, like, government programs and all these different countries, or how do they live?
It depends on the situation. One of my uncles and his wife and kids ended up in Egypt, and Egypt is a fairly simple place to live coming from Yemen, so it's not like a whole new language or system. They have relatives in the U.S. who are supporting them, so that helps. Money from the U.S. goes a long way in certain countries, including Egypt, so they're okay. They're not relying on any, I mean, a lot of these countries have already free education and healthcare for people, so that's helpful, but they're being supported by external parties for sure. A son there, a brother there. My family is supporting my sister and her kids, partially supporting them, mainly actually, in Malaysia while they are still there. My brother Nima is actually working, so he's okay for now. He's working with an NGO in the capital. And then my other siblings who are in UAE are working, and US, yeah, they're working. So we kind of pool sometimes together and send money. You know, any urgent needs, we're always there, obviously, but...
Yeah, so family's for it. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
And what kind of work does your brother do as an NGO in Yemen?
He's got a business background, so he's just sort of helping with some logistics with the NGO as far as communication and planning events and travel and all that. It's very minimal, but it keeps him a little stable and yeah. a little sane as far as having a purpose in yeah. this chaos. And he just started going to school for his master's.
Here in the States, you know, you see a lot of this reclaiming the land, reclaiming yourself. Is there any of that kind of thing happening where the people are coming together on a community level, kind of helping each other out? Or is it, because it's so rural and distant, is it less of that?
Less of that. I know there are some efforts that I'm aware of, mm-hmm. The youth mainly, mm-hmm. a lot of youth movements. There's a group that I particularly love watching and following their work called Himmat Shabab. They're youth who have helped with humanitarian aid, with health-related needs, with street cleanup, even sexual harassment awareness campaigns. So a lot of things to help sort of the day-to-day things in the country, and they haven't stopped that work. It's been only exacerbated as far as the need to have more things in because of the war. Beyond that, I think it's just been city to city, locality to locality, family to family. I mean, it's just tough because of the political situation there. Mm-hmm. It's very unstable. A lot of people are very insecure about doing anything or moving or sort of staying to themselves. And in the South, they have their own internal conflicts happening right now. In the North, the Houthis have a pretty strong hold, strong grasp on the government and any functions of movements, if you will. It's been difficult. A lot of the support has been planned and discussed here in the U.S., actually, mm-hmm. and abroad, not just in the U.S., but different countries, to try to figure out how to help individuals or families or groups over there. And then working with some, you know, State Department organizations or international organizations, it's usually easier to do it that way because of security and mm-hmm. resource allocation and trusting that process.
You know, that's crazy. You're trying to help people out on a humanitarian level, and there's so many of these little or big, you know, layers on top of it that make it almost impossible. You know, then it starts with the financial hardships, mm-hmm. and then you realize that, oh, you know what, there's a security measure, a security issue, a threat, or, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it is. So between the bans and having to go to, you know, proxy countries to go meet with your family, like, I can't imagine, like, both the financial burdens and the emotional, and, like, how do you stay afloat? How do you breathe?
Well, I mean, again, we're fortunate to be out here that we can sort of have room to breathe and think about these things objectively and try to be more flexible in helping when we can. It's just the thought of not knowing when this is going to end and if, you know, will we suddenly lose communication with our family who's mm-hmm. there. The thing that keeps me afloat and hopeful is just the resilience of the people there. I mean, I talk to my brother sometimes. He'll mention a wedding they went to or a party. I mean, they still do that despite the situation. And it's nice to hear that these things are still happening as long as they have the option to do that as far as the security level on any given day. You know, staying in touch and contact with family regularly helps just to kind of make sure that they have that ability and, you know, talk about day-to-day ideas. And that's helpful. That's mainly it, really. I mean, beyond that, it's just really hard because there's not a vested interest in having that situation resolved by anybody. There isn't a lot of oil in the country that allows other countries to kind of get to intervene. Mm-hmm. There isn't a lot of business interest there. Anything has fled the country. A lot of huge brain drain, which is unfortunate. Mm. It's going to take generations to rebuild the country and what's been lost. But the hope is that we will do that one day. Mm-hmm. The people of Yemen, Yemenis in general, are very resilient. It's one of the oldest civilizations in the region, thousands and thousands of years, older than most of the current oil-rich Gulf countries who are there. So it's sort of like a sign, a testament to the resilience of the people there. And just the activism of the global community. A lot of countries, a lot of people in different countries are now more and more active and, you know, creating awareness and speaking out on behalf of Yemen, from the local grassroots of any community to congressional activities, mm-hmm. if you will, because of the situation lasting this long and people not aware of the day-to-day of Yemen. Things kind of get slid under the news cycles. Mm-hmm. We have a new news cycle of different things every day now that these things are just low priority to a lot of people, unfortunately.
Yeah, definitely noticed that the coverage has dwindled. Last time we spoke, you mentioned that a lot of the great minds of the country are leaving just because they feel unsafe mm-hmm. or just because they can't, you know, like living in limbo is very hard for, you know, academics or people to work and stuff. Do you see any of the outside or the people who have left being vocal about what's happening? Do you see more hope in people living in diaspora than the people who have to deal with the situation every day?
Absolutely. I there's a very small yet very active Yemeni communities in the U.S. And more of these intellectuals or scientists or doctors or that come from Yemen or leave Yemen end up in these communities. And so there is dialogue in these communities, and there's outspoken people that come up and help the dialogue and help the narrative, and it creates more activism and more awareness. So it's actually working. They're not just coming and sort of hiding under the, or, you know, in the shadows, if you will. Mm-hmm. They're actually being active participants in communities. A lot of students have come here to study, and they're now under protective visas because of them not being able to go back and the lack of scholarship funding that they were here on. The State Department and the U.S. worked on a deal to allow for these temporary protective visas mm-hmm. for students who were here and suddenly the war disrupted wow. their studies. And so, but it's limited, you know, it's like 2 years at a time. But some of these students have been very active in vocalizing the issue, and not politically or causing any unwanted attention. It's just more like awareness to the local communities they're part of, whether they create groups of support or educational workshops or just sharing their skills or knowledge here to help create awareness that way as well. Even in the Portland area, we have a very small Yemeni community, but we're very active in trying to address the needs of the community here in the U.S., first and foremost, because they're coming here and needing support. But also, how can we as a collective help the situation in Yemen if possible, whether it's working with groups for humanitarian aid or educational services or just sort of creating venues to have dialogue with lawmakers to help facilitate that process. So we're looking into anything and everything because we have that freedom here to do that, and we have the willingness.
I noticed that a couple of times you mentioned it's not political, that the people aren't doing something political. Mm-hmm. Why do you emphasize that?
It's a great question. It's because the situation in Yemen is still unstable in general, but it's also still very political. There are those who lean towards the work of the coalition in the U.S. to try to rid the Yemen of the Houthis. And there are people who side with the local sentiment of, you know, we don't want intervention by Saudi or the UAE, and we want to deal with our issues internally. So that's creating sort of a rift in the country about which side you're on, if you will. And unfortunately, that percolates up to different communities when people end up leaving. And so people are just afraid to vocally take a side. We're here to help the Yemeni people in the humanitarian situation. That's it. I don't want to take a side. I don't care whose fault. I don't care who's doing what politically. Our main focus is the people, and that's a good way to begin a dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's been that way for the past 5 years, where it's been sensitive to talk about any situation in Yemen without the bias of the side that's coming from.
Yeah.
And especially early on when the bombing campaign started, there was a huge rift of those who were in alignment with the coalition and those who were in alignment with the local government who's trying to, quote-unquote, defend the country and the people on the ground. And it left many people confused as to what's happening. And, you know, especially with the news bias and some of the sources of media that the information comes from, people weren't sure who's telling the truth. So that's still happening, and that's why I say that, because I feel people, if you want to focus on the humanitarian aid and the people and the issues that are impacting the people, it's a safer bet, and you get more accomplished, and you're more productive that way than to suddenly bring up an issue that has to do with one side versus the other.
That's, it's a disarming, just straightforward way, just helping the people that are most affected. Yeah. And when you explain the situation or talk about the situation to people in the States, Americans, do they understand it, or do they get political about it? Do they want to know, like, whose fault is it, or do they understand that approach?
Not necessarily, but it's good to bring it up for context. Mm-hmm. People most likely will ask, what's happening in Yemen? How did it really start again? Like, they forget. It's not like something, it's not a narrative or storyline that's in people's minds constantly. There's always a gap of understanding, and then you have to refresh their memory of how it started, what's happening now. Not so much as whose fault it was, but just the factual timeline events that happened. This is how it started, this is what happened next, and this is what's happening next, and then any movements to address the issue and who is leading those movements. The general narrative is that, yes, it's a proxy war between Saudi and Iran in Yemen because of the Houthis' backing of Iran and the UN-recognized government in Saudi. On the ground, it's much more complex than that.
Of course.
People don't see it that way. They see it as survival. They see it as the world abandoning the case for Yemen. And, you know, at the same time, people have changed their opinions in their minds by leaving Yemen or coming here, as far as what's happening, when they have a more unbiased lens to what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably easier also when you're
away from the danger.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been complex in all areas. I mean, it's an understatement, but the main thing that really bothers me and most of my peers is just how lacking the efforts are to get a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And no one really is, no one is vested enough to be able to be the convening. I mean, the UN is really supposed to be that body,
mm-hmm.
but even the UN's actions have been sort of criticized by multiple sides of the issue. So
obviously you have a lot of big players that are, you know, like we said, a proxy war. There's two big players, and it, a lot of people are don't want to get into it. Meanwhile, you have millions of people that are suffering so much from it.
Yeah.
And going back to the humanitarian part of it, aside from the people who have obviously, it's like devastating what's happening to them, what about the actual infrastructure? Has any of the hospitals been repaired or any of the actual...
As far as I know, these major repairs haven't happened yet. I mean, there might be a few things locally where people have put together efforts or companies on the ground. But overall, as a system, it's very minimal as far as repair or restoration. On a daily basis, we hear about people dying of simple things, you know, like not having dialysis available.
Mm.
Not simple, but just things that in the U.S. wouldn't be a cause to lose someone's life, complications to surgery, or lack of diabetic medication. So as a system, it's a failure, obviously. There was a huge spread of cholera early on, which hasn't been in the news as much. So I think there's been some efforts to remedy that a little bit with campaigns and international intervention.
Mm-hmm.
But as a health system, it's still not, you know, it's just the way it is right now. Again, international organizations are there on the ground trying to help the situation, but they can only do so much. And they prioritize based on the most need. And currently it's the rural areas, which I understand. That's the effort.
Doesn't it seem kind of like a snake that's going to eat its own tail, or whatever the phrase goes, where it's like they're trying to combat the most urgent stuff in, let's say, rural areas, but it's a lack of infrastructure and, like, for say, clean pipes for the water that's causing these kind of outbreaks to happen. So now they're putting all their efforts into trying to put basically a Band-Aid on something. Meanwhile, it's bound to just happen again, you know? Mm-hmm. So as a healthcare professional, like, what...
Yeah,
how do you stop the madness?
It's complicated. I mean, my background is public health. Right now, I manage primary care teams, OHSU, if I can say that. So I understand what's needed to have a robust primary care system.
Mm-hmm.
When we don't have that right now. We have basically emergency medicine. And in emergency medicine, even here in the U.S., you have the essentials to stabilize people, and they have that to some extent, but there's nothing to deal with chronic illnesses there. There's nothing to deal with. You know, I'm not sure even how the vaccination campaigns are happening. I'm not sure what's happening with the various health issues that were on track to be addressed or solved before the war.
Oh.
And there's no system to be able to keep track of that. I mean, the public health structure is not functioning. There's no government function, no government structure is functioning appropriately for us to even get that data, right?
Hmm.
What we know is from what we hear from on the ground and news sources, and then the international community who are there. They see the cholera spread, the disease, the deaths from common chronic illnesses that have treatments. Yes, it's complicated, and you prioritize based on what's going to impact the most people now, tomorrow, day after, and you hope for the best. And I mean, education is probably the key point, element that people are trying to address with cholera. It was washing your hands, and this is how you properly use hygiene techniques, and this is how you cook your food. Things like that helped mitigate that issue. But relying on international or other humanitarian aid to help with, like, medication shortages and healthcare professionals, that's an issue as well. I know that when our dad was feeling he needed recovery at home, we tried to find a competent, qualified nurse to be at home. It was difficult. The qualified people are lacking more and more.
Because they leave, right?
They leave, or they're just not... There's not a way for them to function without having to have their services, you know, compensated for.
Interesting.
And people still do that voluntarily. There's a lot of volunteer work going on, which is great. I mean, again, the resilience of the people is outstanding, but for how long, you know?
Yeah.
So.
And meanwhile, you know, it's another thing that I, you know, was just thinking about is when just because a war breaks out doesn't stop people from, like, for example, having children or being sick.
Life is moving on, which is, again, probably... Why that's hopeful is when people are just living their life day to day, that's hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
At least they're not having to put everything on hold for a war that may never end in the next whatever how many years. So I love hearing those stories, weddings and having babies and graduations and people starting businesses mm-hmm. in the midst of all that. It's just great, you know. It's and following that on, you know, social media, with a lot of artists have actually sent their work to the U.S. and won awards, and they couldn't even be here to see that. A couple of people have been part of Emmy-winning shows and Oscar-winning movies from their work remotely, from, you know, and not being able to come here and share that. So it's a way for us to see that life can be improved drastically with time. It's just mm-hmm. when.
Life finds a way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's so interesting to hear back. Unfortunately, not too much has changed, but your personal life has changed a lot, and just being, you know, affected by knowing what's going on with your family, extended family, the unfortunate passing of your father. The work that you do you ever think of, like, ways to bring it back to Yemen or kind of...
Yeah, it's often a thought of mine mm-hmm. is how to use what I do here to help the situation there. And besides the obvious just awareness and mm-hmm. making people more aware about who I am, my background, and what it means to me that this is happening, I'm constantly working with local leaders and organizations to try to figure out a way to either aid in humanitarian aid, which obviously is more difficult because of the resources, the lack mm-hmm. of resources, or just to help the local Yemeni community survive this and help their families. So my professional side, it's really hard to use that to leverage it unless I know of something that can be shared with them mm-hmm. as far as health related. I don't know if I mentioned, I serve on the Portland Community College Board of Trustees.
Okay.
I was elected 3 years ago. So I use that as a point of platform, if you mm-hmm. will, to bring awareness, education, and whatever we do here for our college and students. I try to see how I can use that to pass on information to help other educational needs in Yemen, for example. Everyone's been supportive. That's mm-hmm. great for me to hear that. As far as whatever you need us to do, let us know, we can help. So, but beyond that, really, it's hard. It's hard without really being able to financially support, and then of course supporting our families locally and abroad, as far as just direct support with financial support. That's usually the best and most that anyone can do. There's a large Yemeni community in the East Coast in New York. Majority of them own bodegas, stores, and supermarkets. They've pooled together the resources, and they're now a really strong voice to help advocate with Congress, for example, to help some of the legislative decisions that are impacting Yemen. So that's an effort that we can support locally from here by either joining the voices over there on the East Coast or coming up with our own plan, I guess, mm-hmm. if you will, to help escalate. And we have some great supportive congressional people here in Oregon. Senator Wyden and Merkley have been great to mm-hmm. talk to, and they're very reachable and accessible. So for us to escalate those concerns to them has been helpful. So things like that, I think a lot of my Yemeni colleagues, Yemeni American colleagues, are doing that anyway.
Yeah, because the more that our elected representatives know what we care about, then they'll start caring about it. So Yeah,
it's absolutely true. And there's a story back, I think almost more than a year ago now, maybe I mentioned it last time I was here, where Oregon itself had been directly involved in the humanitarian efforts in Yemen. There was 7 giant cargo ships full of wheat from the mm-hmm. Pacific Northwest sent to Yemen, specifically to the humanitarian effort from the UN. So that was really impactful for me personally to see that happening, and that helped create some awareness locally.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we sending this much wheat, and what's it for? Elected officials spoke and endorsed it, and so it was a good collaborative effort to bring that issue to light. We just need more of that.
Have there been any kind of projects like that since then, or that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. I think it's just been sort of from other sources, mm-hmm. and, you know, I'm not sure. Nothing from Oregon that I'm aware of, yeah.
And are there any local advocacy groups or any kind of nonprofits that you'd recommend besides the usual suspects like the Red Cross and all?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mercy Corps was doing some work there. I'm not mm-hmm. sure any specific efforts on their part at this point. Not that I can think of right now. I mean, there's a lot of informal groups that are doing mm-hmm. things, obviously. I volunteer at the Muslim Educational Trust, which is a pretty known organization in Portland, mm-hmm. which is an educational resource center, but it's usually a convener of anything like this, obviously, for not just for Yemen necessarily, but we came together for other needs in the community, for the synagogue attacks, for the Max stabbing, for the travel ban, the DACA situation.
Mm-hmm.
We come together as a community to help address those issues, and so that's been also a topic of concern, is how do we bring awareness to the Yemen situation.
So you're very socially active in the city as well. Like, you are just a, I don't want to say political person.
Well, I'm an elected official, quote unquote, yeah, being on PCC. But because of that, that was a platform for me to get to know other electeds. And I have a really small, close-knit group of electeds in Washington County that I meet with regularly. And we discuss a lot of issues. And they're very supportive. And they're all up-and-coming leaders, which I'm proud to know. And we're trying to figure out ways where we can be supportive of each other in other areas, our pet projects or concerns or issues of kind of passion that we want each other's help on. So that's been a fun experience over the past year, and I'm proud of that. So,
do you have any pet projects that you're most excited about for the upcoming year?
Not yet, but I think collectively we're supporting each other on what each is working on in their own individual realm, if you will. But more creating awareness and getting out the vote and campaigning for candidates that we support that are aligning their values with our values, helping to educate up-and-coming rising leaders who are interested in the process. We've done that. We've had some mentoring. So we're doing a lot of informal things via just us being a collective, but nothing formal yet that we can probably share. So,
well, that's I'm excited. Talk with you next time about it. And you bring me to the next point, which is the 2020 election.
Wow. Well, things change every day as far as that, the prospect of the 2020 election. And this recent thing with Iran is creating another variable, if you will, for that. But it's exciting to see the narratives and dialogue that are happening to help identify who the candidates are going to be, you know, who's going to be leading the Democratic Party, who's going to run against Donald Trump. That's been exciting to watch. Some great candidates on the Democratic side that I've been able to follow and see some glimpses of hope. But there's been a lot of implications with that election. And I'm hopeful, but I'm also concerned as to what happens next. And it's been a very tough 3 years with the current administration, for me personally. I mean, I know that people have their opinion and as far as how politics goes, but for me personally and my values, it's been disastrous. But I'm hopeful because of the response to the disastrous situations, like people involved, the activism, the protests, the how many people voted the last midterm election was just inspiring. And so if that stays the course the way it's been, I'm hopeful as far as getting more people involved and having a more meaningful election than just we have some of the lowest percentage of turnout in the world as far as developed countries. And that's really sad, but hopefully it's changing in the next few elections. So yeah, we'll see what happens. I'm watching it like everyone else.
Yeah, that kind of seems to be the general consensus, is hopeful but concerned. So
yeah,
same here. You mentioned that for obvious reasons, the current president, his administration has made your life harder, you know, for obvious reasons. But can you just name off just a couple of ways?
Well, it's not just me, obviously.
Yeah.
It's a lot of areas have been impacted negatively. There's some positive impact that people can list, obviously. The economy, like, obviously, is doing great. People are always, but it's not great for everyone. We haven't had any movement in the people in most need as far as the economy. But as far as other impact, I mean, I share this with people all the time. I mean, in healthcare, for example, the impact that the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid funding sources that have been impacted by the administration have impacted people I know, family members who are on those plans, for example. The travel ban that happened and was repealed and then it was reinstated has literally prevented my family from visiting me. The situation as it relates to the rhetoric, as it relates to people's rhetoric around immigrants and immigration has caused a lot of anxiety in my communities. We've seen some of it manifest into violent acts. These are just three simple examples of that as far as what that means. I mean, even the immigration process that was in place for many, many years, the legal immigration process has been impacted, and that impacted my family members who are in the process, who may or may not ever get the chance to come here legally. The refugee process has been impacted negatively, and my other members, family members who are refugees currently waiting for a chance to have relocation are impacted because of the fact that we cut down the number of refugees to minimal numbers. So several areas that are directly impactful.
To name a few,
yeah. But, you know, again, it's the positive response to that has been inspiring for people to stand up for those who need it, for immigration rights, for violent crimes, for anti-Semitic crimes. The response has been great. And so I hope that people can carry that forward to into the future.
Yeah, I'm sure
we're
that
all there in solidarity, obviously.
Yeah,
so
definitely. What are your, if you want to share some of your opinions about the Healthcare for All Act that is, I guess, up at the Congress right now? I'm not sure where it is right now. Is it the Senate?
Yeah, there's several legislations being proposed. There's some state level and there's obviously federal.
Yeah.
I know that federally they talk about Medicare for All, for example. Locally, where it's Healthcare for All for Oregon. I'm a big fan of that, being public health. I understand people's concerns about having government insurance or government coverage or universal health care, but mainly it's misrepresented what it is. I think the goal is to have the very minimal coverage for everyone in the community, in the society. And then anything beyond that can be up to people's means and work insurance and all those things. But right now, as a country, we have millions and millions of people who have zero insurance or minimal insurance. And so to get that base level is what we need. Just to begin with, unfortunately, it's always seen as negative or given terms like socialized medicine or, you know, welfare medicine, but it's not. Other countries have had that for years and they're thriving in that environment, developing countries, not just. So I would like to see a situation, a scenario where everyone has basic coverage, health insurance, or access to healthcare in general. And then, of course, I'm not really sure how abolishing all the insurance companies is going to work. I don't see that happening. But there can be a dual system, like most countries have.
You heard it straight from you, the professional, our local healthcare guru. That's
how I'm gonna, that, yeah. I'm still learning too. The system is so complicated. I think it's a lot of times I laugh when I try to explain our healthcare system to people from different countries because of how complicated it is. But yet, the simple solution in their mind is, why don't you just give everyone health insurance, or why don't you give everyone free health access to? Well, it's more than just that. It's other. You know, other factors at play. So
that's so interesting that, you know, you have all these countries that are, it's, we'll get there, you know?
And we have, I mean, supposedly we have one of the best healthcare systems in the world. I don't think that's true as far as access, but we also have some of the lowest outcomes for a developing country. So there's no, you can't reconcile the fact that we think we have the greatest healthcare system, but then the outcomes aren't the best.
Yeah.
And so there's a discrepancy in that. We need to align that.
Numbers don't lie. That doesn't make sense. Yeah. So what are your, do you have any kind of goals for the upcoming year?
Goals, resolutions. Well, it's just, I mean, simplistically, I was talking to family about just more time with family, more coordinated efforts to have open dialogue with people about what's happening in our communities. I'd love to travel more. I think travel is so eye-opening. Sometimes I would encourage family and friends to travel if they can, just to see other perspectives globally as well as, you know, other communities. And just sort of be... I hate to use the word woke. It's a good word, but I mean, people are now misusing it. And so about what's happening in our community and just basically helping any causes that align with my values however I can. I mean, I don't want to be stagnant as far as that. I want to be well-meaning and productive when I can, however I can.
I hope that for myself as well and for all the listeners. And thank you so much, Mohammed, for agreeing to speak with me. Any final thoughts?
Thank you. It's been my pleasure talking to you, Tammy, as usual. And I just wish everyone a happy new year and looking forward to a happy, prosperous 2020.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I'd like to thank Mohammed for sharing his story with us today. I know it wasn't easy for him, losing his father, all the turmoil that his family has been going through. I want you all to remember that there are still bans, travel bans, happening to people here in the United States. A lot of people from Iran are being treated like they don't belong here. Although they were born here and are carrying citizenship papers, they are still being stopped at the border. From Iran to Iraq to Yemen to Palestine, I just want you all to remember, there is something that we can do. And right now, the people of Yemen need you. There are various ways online that you can figure out how to donate. There are local organizations, and most importantly, call your local representative. If they see that we care, then they will care as well. For Hindsight 2020 and Cable Community Radio, this is Tammy Hoptius. أو تضحكني من فوق السنون
من كل حبة قبة قصدهم يرموا في بحر الظنون لا 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 تحاول أن تصور من كل حبة قبة أو تضحكني من فوق السنون بلا أسباب تجرني ولا تشتي تصارحني بلا أسباب تجرني ولا تشتي تصارحني.
This is KBOO Portland. Time is 5 o'clock. Coming up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of In the Blast Zone, a panel on tar sands by rail on Tuesday, January 21st from 7 to 9 p.m. at Patagonia in Portland. In 2018, the Zenith Energy Oil Terminal opened, the first tar sands by rail export terminal on the West Coast. The Center for a Sustainable Economy hosts this panel discussion with activists fighting tar sands by rail in the Pacific Northwest. Again, that's In the Blast Zone, a panel on tar sands by rail on Tuesday, January 21st from 7 to 9 p.m. at Patagonia, 1106 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm. On the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
You're listening to Hindsight's 2020, a day of special programming debriefing the last 3 years under the Trump regime.
Thanks for listening.